Welcome to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM on your dial. Next up, Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only queer radio hour. Hold on tight. And thank you so much for tuning in. You are listening to WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM on your dial, streaming at WRFG.org. Welcome to Alternative Perspectives. This is Atlanta's only local radio hour exclusively devoted to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. And I am your host, Greg Bossen, and thank you so much for listening. Before I go any further, the opinions expressed here are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily represent the views of WRFG, its employees, board, volunteers, funders, or listeners. So how is everybody doing? It's been, well, a little bit cooler, but overall, man, it's been hot. It's been crazy, crazy hot. But I mean, that's typical for a summer here in Atlanta, right? Las Margaritas burned last night. If those of you who aren't aware of that, Las Margaritas is on Cheshire Bridge Road, a Mexican restaurant right next to Rocks on the same street, Cheshire Bridge, where there was a fire on Friday, I think. So I don't know, all of Cheshire Bridge is burning. I don't know what the story is, but, and this is my personal opinion, Las Margaritas was probably one of the worst Mexican restaurants that I've ever eaten at in my life. So no love lost there for me. But anyway, I apologize for anybody who suffered as a result of that fire, maybe losing their job or an owner or something that is no longer in business. But anyway, so that's kind of sad. But as far as our show goes tonight, I mentioned this on the news last week. Gilead, the pharmaceutical company, awarded $2.9 million to nonprofits across the state, across the South, I'm sorry, to combat the spread of HIV. This happened last month. And we have the executive director of one of the organizations that received funding. The organization is called Counter Narrative Project, or CNP for short. They've been around for a few years, and we have the executive director and the founder, Charles Stevens, on the show tonight to talk about the organization. I love the name, Counter Narrative Project, and what they're doing to help change the narrative and help Black gay men in Atlanta. But before we get to that,
news of the queer.
I know that's right.
Oh, no, she didn't say what.
All right. And I wanted to start, as usual, with COVID. Sorry, folks. And we have a new record. Yesterday, we had 12,737 new cases of COVID in the state of Georgia. According to what I am seeing, that is the largest number of one-day cases that has occurred that I can find. So that's not good. The seven-day average is 5,423 cases. Has not been that high since the very beginning of the year. So I'm hoping that people will wake up and start getting vaccinated. What else do we have here? Hungary continuing it's the government's assault on LGBTQ. On August 6th, Hungary issued a decree that restricts the sales of children's books with LGBTQ specific themes. Reuters reported the decree mandates bookstores to sell children's books that Prime Minister Viktor Orban's government has concluded promote homosexuality in closed wrapping. The decree requires bookstores to sell children's books that Orban's government says promote sex reassignment surgery and contain explicit descriptions of sexuality separately. the sale of these books within 656 feet, 200 meters, of a school or a church is prohibited. So anyway, there we go there. The U.S. Census Bureau announced Thursday that its Household Pulse survey is now asking respondents their sexual orientation and gender identity in addition to their sex. The questions are part of Phase 3.2 of the survey, the latest update to an experimental data collection effort to measure the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on American households. So that's cool. This marks the first time the Bureau has asked questions regarding gender identity. So good for them. Let's see. Anything else I want to say before? Well, so the Olympics is over, in case you didn't notice, which a lot of people didn't. People just aren't as into it as they used to be. Guess we got other things to worry about. As the torch goes out at Japan National Stadium, the end has arrived for the 2020 Tokyo Summer Games that, of course, took place in 2021. Dubbed the Rainbow Olympics by some for the record number of LGBTQ competitors, at least 182 out athletes from approximately 30 nations attended the Tokyo Games, more than three times the number of out athletes who competed in the 2016 Summer Games in Rio. Of those athletes who competed in some 35 different sports, at least 55 medaled. Five nabbed gold for Team USA's women's basketball alone. In fact, this is what's cool. If the LGBTQ Olympians competed as their own country, wow, a whole gay country, affectionately labeled Team LGBTQ by Outsports, they would rank 11th in the total medal count, right behind France and before Canada. Isn't that crazy? So we kicked butt. And then finally, and this just happened this morning, Twitter has suspended Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's account for 1 week following yet another violation of the platform's rules, the company said. Green tweeted yesterday that the Food and Drug Administration should not approve COVID vaccines. She also claimed the vaccines were failing and that they were ineffective at reducing the virus's spread. In response, Twitter labeled the tweet as misleading and prevented Green from tweeting for 1 week. Idiot. Anyway. And that's it, and we will be right back.
What's up? It's Pickles. We have a message.
Hey, I'm calling you back. Ooh, she's been up tonight. I mean this rain. No cab, nowhere. So I had to put on the wigs and the heels and the lashes and the ear and take the train to the club. And you know the MTA should stand for mother touching my ass. So then I get to the club, looking like a drowned, harassed rat, and am greeted not by Miss Rose at the door, but our friend Johnny.
Let's have a kiki.
I want to have a kiki.
Lock the door.
All right. Thank you so much again for joining us. That obviously was Let's Have a Kiki by the Scissor Sisters, which came out a few years back. and welcome back to WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM. This again is Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. I am your host, Greg Bossen. So, and now it's time for the show. Now, earlier this summer, I don't know the exact date, it was either in late June or early July, A pharmaceutical, or the pharmaceutical company, Gilead, or Gilead, if you have no idea how to pronounce it. But anyway, through its Compass Initiative, granted 29 nonprofit organizations across the South funds totaling $2.9 million. And the reason for the gift is to help combat the spread of HIV in the South. And we have the executive director and founder of one of those organizations, Charles Stevens, from Counter Narrative Project, or CNP for short. First of all, I want to thank you, Charles, for being here so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. And I have to tell you that I am fascinated. I've done a little bit of research, and I'm fascinated with your organization, and particularly its mission around shifting historical and current narratives about Black gay men. And I'm also curious about your story growing up here in Atlanta. You're a native, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, which you don't see that too much. You were born in Grady, which I'm impressed with. But before we get to that, I wanted to spend a few minutes on the grant itself that you got and its intended impact on the state of HIV in the Black gay community in particular. Here in Atlanta. So I did a little bit of searching, and for years, Georgia has been near the top of states with the highest rates of HIV and AIDS. In parts of Atlanta and the metro region, rates are as much as 8 times the national average, and researchers say they rival levels found in some developing countries. All right. And how did this happen? How did Metro Atlanta become an epicenter of the HIV/AIDS epidemic? Poverty, lack of health insurance, inadequate sex education, and stigma, particularly for young LGBTQ plus people who are shunned by their families and end up on the street. These problems exist in many urban areas. However, Atlanta is also majority Black, and the virus is disproportionately affecting Black people, especially young Black men who have sex with men. According to AIDSVU, a database produced in partnership with Emory University, the rate of Black men living with HIV is actually 5 times that of white men. And for Black women, it's 15 times greater. So I wanted to start by asking you, why is this happening in your view? Why are the rates of infection so much higher among the Black gay community? And what are your plans for addressing it?
Absolutely. Well, before I address what seems not to be working and the challenges, I want to begin by just sharing my absolute respect for people in Atlanta, in Georgia, that are doing great work. I mean, obviously, there are considerable challenges and obstacles that we face as we seek to address and respond to the impact of HIV, but there are also people doing some really great work. And I think far too often in these sort of stories, we don't always look at organizations that are in Atlanta, in Georgia, that have for years been on the front lines, engaged in very courageous advocacy, engaged in tireless work. You know, CNP is joined by just incredible comrades in the work. Organizations such as Sister Love, organizations such as NASM, organizations such as Thrive SS. There are just so many, Atlanta Harm Reduction. There are just so many organizations that do the work. And I find that far too often that the leadership, the courageous and innovative and brave leadership that we find in the HIV movement, that we don't really get a chance to hear those stories, that we don't really get a chance to see. And it as you can imagine, it's a very daunting task. But even with that, despite the considerable obstacles that we face, there's leadership. But to answer your question directly about,
can I just say one thing?
Sure.
Charles, good for you for starting that way, because I'm sure that you know, if you've been a member and you have been a member of the activist community in Atlanta, there's a lot of infighting. that happens. And I think it's really important and great that you started by giving kudos to some of the organizations that have been around a lot longer than you have. So good for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I talked about being an Atlanta native, but I really see the work that I do in part as having been made possible. Well, one, by the civil rights legacy of Atlanta that I stand in the tradition of, but also the tradition of the HIV movement. I don't know if I would be able to do this work if it wasn't for the courageous folks. I mean, we could, of course, talk about, you know, ACT UP and Queer Nation and that part of Atlanta's movement history, but also organizations like Sister Love, like NASUM, like Atlanta Harm Reduction, that's just to name a few, that have been around for years, even before I became involved in activism or organizing work, that I think in many ways created a movement landscape that I could be a part of. You know, organizations that understood the impact of HIV as not only being about individual choices, about passing out condoms, about testing and things like that, but they also understood the impact of HIV is about being about racial justice, as being about gender justice, as being about access to healthcare, these structural concerns. And I think that's sort of where my leadership and the role of CMP, where we take our lead from these organizations, because, you know, their analysis and their worldview aligns with ours. A lot of times when we think about HIV, we think about it, you know, we think about the impact, we want to blame people. You know, why don't you know? And why are you still? And it's not just about, and that's been our analysis and lens at CMP. It's not just about, you know, we reject a frame that blames individuals. We look at the failure of institutions. We look at the failure of healthcare institutions. Why are there still these, you know, considerable barriers to healthcare that people face as they're trying to access healthcare? You know, and how do we knock down those barriers? How do we create openings so that anyone that wants to access healthcare can access healthcare? So that's really our perspective. And again, we see ourselves in this amazing community of other movement leaders and organizers. You know, I definitely have been poured into and fed by some of my elders in the movement and have been inspired by, you know, you talked about infighting. And, you know, of course, obviously in any, you know, in any movement, there's going to be that part, but there's also just mentorship and nurturing. And I want to make sure I hold that up.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So, and so you have kind of alluded to kind of the answer to my original question. So if we could flesh it out a little bit more, why is HIV such a problem still in the Black gay community? You've alluded to it, but flesh it out a little bit for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are many ways to think about how, just to talk specifically about Black gay men. Of course, there are, you know, many.
Yes, that's what I want to do.
Impacted, but if we just talk specifically about the community that I'm a part of. You know, I mean, I think that there are, you know, many things to consider. I think the starting point, again, is looking at barriers to healthcare, barriers to prevention, treatment, and care. I think that we also must look at the cultural competence of healthcare providers. Are they asking the right questions? Are they creating an environment where if someone comes in for any services related to HIV, that they're being taken care of and that they're being respected, that their dignity is being upheld. I also think it's important to just look at the landscape of services. You know, I mean, I think we still have a long way to go to ensure that HIV prevention tools and strategies like PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and, you know, still made available. That we have a long way to go to make sure that people living with HIV, that Black gay men living with HIV, are also able to have access to treatment and care services. So when I think about like the impact, I think about institutions, I think about organizations, I think about the failure, quite frankly, of a lot of these institutions to adequately provide the needed services. And I also think about the necessity of having community organizations and community institutions that can adequately respond to the community. I think I always tell healthcare providers that it's not enough just to provide services that you should know something about the communities that you're serving. You should create an environment so that way when individuals from, let's say, Black gay men come into these healthcare settings, that they are affirmed, that they do feel valued, that they do have a sense of, they do feel a sense of concern. And so that the journey from getting from their house to getting into, to getting to service isn't, you know, it just, the barriers just aren't as robust that we currently find.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to challenge you to just kind of, so that the listeners can get a clear picture, because I think there's a lot of people in Atlanta that have no idea what it's like to grow up as a Black gay man in Atlanta. So let's say you're a 15-year-old or 16-year-old kid, or maybe 17 or 20, and you're living, you know, in the West End off Cascade Road, and you're realizing that you're gay, and you're getting out there and you're having sexual experiences. And I mean, explain to Atlanta what the experience is like for this kid, and why it is that this kid is not able to access these services.
Well, let me just step back a bit. Mm-hmm. Well, one, I think this is a dilemma and challenge that we're all facing. Obviously, no one's completely solved this problem, right? Because it's still, the impact is still there. What I will say is that, let's talk about what seems to be working or what has seemed to work. And I would offer four things. So now, so we know what the challenge is, right? We know that the challenge is that, you know, in 2021, there are communities that are still being impacted by HIV disproportionately. My response to that is, well, let's look at some of the things that are working and how can we scale those things up to have a better impact. Some of the things that works as we understand it are things like, one, ensuring that there's, again, cultural competent healthcare, that physicians, healthcare providers are culturally competent, so they're not creating a stigmatizing environment for, you know, in this case, Black gay men that are coming in for service. So that's one.
Two, so you're saying that, like, if I'm a Black gay man and I come, sometimes I have a hard time finding a doctor that is going to be understanding of my situation and recommending PrEP to begin with?
Yes.
Okay. So there's doctors in Atlanta that aren't doing that. And that's if you can have insurance to get to a doctor, right?
Well, I think that we need to understand better what are the specific barriers to accessing PrEP. One of them is obviously administrative. Another one is having healthcare providers that are able to ask questions and engage in conversations. I think that, I mean, it's hard to, I think that there are a lot of different kinds of experiences and a lot of different kinds of obstacles and challenges. So I'm reluctant to say that this is a universal problem across Atlanta, because I think it also doesn't do service to physicians that are really good at having conversation. What I'm saying is that we need to figure out how to better scale up and replicate the things that are working, such as, for example, having culturally competent physicians that can have conversations about PrEP, for example, and healthcare providers. And again, there are some that are doing it. We just need to make sure we're doing it more. We need to make sure that there are culturally competent case managers and service providers. I think that's critically important. We need to make sure that there are the barriers that exist to people accessing healthcare, such as economic distress, such as transportation issues, that those barriers are eliminated as much as possible so that people are able to connect to healthcare and they're not facing these daunting sort of obstacles as they're trying to get to see a healthcare provider. I think there's also a necessity to consider you know, sexual health education, particularly in, you know, for young people, making sure that, you know, we're providing, you know, information in a way that is the best education we could possibly provide to young people, particularly around sexual health. Like, that still is a considerable issue. And so the from my perspective, then, the way that we respond to it is to try to identify the things that are working and scale them up and continue to replicate them. I think that we also see there being a need for people to have community and be able to connect with each other. You know, there still, from my perspective, is a need to have organizations that can kind of do that, even if it's virtual, so that people are able to share their experiences and are able to learn from each other. That we have, there's a, I think even in somewhere like Atlanta that has a considerable LGBTQ community, there's still a lot of social isolation that people face. And I think experiencing social isolation, I think does, it, having a sense of community, I think empowers people to be able to have a sense of agency in accessing the healthcare. I think that these are all things that are really important. I think we need to deal with, you know, emotional wellness. I think that also has to be a part of how we think about providing, you know, a broader sense of healthcare. So I think taken together, there has to be, I think, a daring and bold reimagination about all the facets of healthcare that people should have access to be able to actually see the needle move in some of these challenges.
All right. All right. And I'm going to reintroduce you just a second. For those of you that are just joining us, we are speaking with Charles Stevens, who's the founder and the executive director of the Counter Narrative Project, or CNP. We are talking specifically at this moment about HIV in the Black gay community in Atlanta, which is higher, five times higher than the rest of Atlanta. And so I'm wondering, you grew up here in Atlanta, Charles, so I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about what your experience was like growing up in Atlanta. And in that sense, maybe that'll help people get a better idea of what it's like growing up Black and gay in Atlanta and how that affects your ability to access these services and the support that you need.
Wow, that's a question I haven't been asked in a while. yeah, I would say I'm really grateful to be from Atlanta. I don't think my story is by any means, I don't think my story is any more exceptional or that common. Like, I think that, you know, I think that there are just, I find that there are many experiences that I share with other people from Atlanta, but then there are some unique things, I will say. I think I was very lucky in that I had a family that was very supportive of me, but I also, like many folks that came up around the time that I came up, you know, also, you know, experienced homophobia. But I think that
was that in the 90s?
So I grew up in the 90s. Well, okay. I'm 40, so I was born in 1980. I grew up in the 80s and 90s. I was in high school in the 90s. So I think it was a moment.
What school?
Thurl High School.
Where is that?
It's in Southwest Atlanta. It's you're familiar with Atlanta. It's on the Southwest side.
Okay.
So I think I discovered James Baldwin when I was 12, and I started reading his novels, and that just had an incredible impact on me and my identity development. I also found community as a teenager in the 90s. Again, I found this incredible community of Black gay men that mentored me, that looked out for me, that passed on wisdom, that allowed me to kind of find my way, you know. But when when they saw me perhaps going down paths I shouldn't go down, they also like pulled me back in. So I was just really grateful to have had that experience. And also within community, I started learning about the Atlanta's movement history. So even like, so let's say, you know, when I started college, particularly when I really started, you know, becoming connected to the Black LGBTQ community here, you know, I started learning about Atlanta's movement history. So, you know, you had people that would share stories and that would talk about, so of course they perhaps did not see themselves, for them, they were just doing the work, but I saw them as being heroic. You know, they would share these. And that was kind of in some ways what inspired me to become an activist, because, you know, I would hear the kinds of organizing and the kinds of leadership they were engaged in. And I also felt a sense of responsibility. I felt a sense of wanting to continue that tradition. Like, I remember, for example, meeting Karan Williams, who was at the time a student at Morehouse College, and he in the mid-90s, or rather the early 90s, around 1993 or so, he attempted to start a gay student group on the campus. And so I met him several years after that, and he was kind of sharing with me some of his, both his battle scars, but also some of his wisdom. And I remember just being in awe that he was, you know, of what he had tried to do. He wasn't successful at the time in starting the student group, but I just saw him as being courageous, that he went, you know, he sort of was defiant and took on the administration. And so that was really what I had access to. I met Craig Washington, who at the time was the, you know, he worked at AID Atlanta. He ran the African-American Gay Outreach Program, and just these incredible leaders that cared enough about me to listen to me, to share resources, to guide me, to give me a sense of models that I can kind of look to, to kind of base myself on. And so I always say that I think being from Atlanta, really, I was so lucky. And in some ways, I think my destiny was set, because, you know, I was almost like engineered to be who I am now, because I had these, just all of these individuals coming into my life at a critical moment, particularly when I was in college. So this is the early 2000s by this point. And they were just loving on me and shaping me and giving me these just amazing tools to do my work. And at the time, you know, I wasn't really planning on, I don't think I imagined myself at the time being the executive director of a county narrative project when I was very young. That just wasn't something I was thinking about. But as I started to put in perspective the work that I wanted to do and the kind of voice that I wanted to have, and really the kind of impact I wanted to have in the world, it just all made sense, especially considering the fact that I had these amazing role models and mentor figures that were also, you know, helping to guide me.
Wow. Well, it sounds like that you have been really blessed. I wondered, though, just to go back for a second, when you were young, before you met these people, and you were perhaps discovering your own sexuality, I mean, were you picked on in school? Did you encounter homophobia at all when you were in elementary or in high school before all this started?
This is where it gets interesting. I do recognize, okay. I guess I just want to say that, I get that, you know, there's a narrative about, you know, the Black communities being, you know, more homophobic. And I'm not saying you're saying that, but I know in general, sometimes I come across that. And I mean, I think that even in my own experience, there was, you know, certainly there was violence and there was, you know, terror and fear and, you know, just, I mean, I, you know, I think, yeah, growing up, I think for many of us, there's going to be, and those are some of my experiences too. Like I also had experiences of violence. I had experiences of fear and feeling really alone at times. But then at the same time, you know, from pretty early on, I was also able to find community. So when I think about even my high school years, it was this interesting time, and even middle school to some extent. It's like there were negative things that happened, but there were also positive things. So, you know, on one hand, there would be, let's say in middle school, there would be violence, or even in high school. But then I also had parents that supported me. But let me also say, I sort of came out to my dad sort of later, like when I was like 19 or so, or 18. My mom passed away when I was still in high school, so I didn't really get a chance to have a conversation with her. But I also didn't grow up in a house where they said really homophobic things, right? And that's when I'm saying supportive, I mean, you know, they weren't, I didn't have the parents that were giving the fire and brimstone sermons, even though my dad was a preacher. Like, they never said anything. I never heard homophobia. They just never, even when the LGBTQ subjects came up, I never got the impression that my parents would disown me or throw me away, right? So that was kind of my growing up experience. However, I also got messages from the world that being gay was wrong and a sin. So I think that what I'm grateful for is that though there were negative things that I heard, certainly in experience, I also had, if not positive reinforcement, certainly reinforcement that told me I was okay and that I'm okay as who I am. And I really think that having those positive experiences gave me the courage or the resilience or the strength, inner strength, to be able to face even when there would be negative experiences. And when I didn't have, and again, and when I did, even when I didn't have people in my life telling me it was okay, there were also, you know, again, reading James Baldwin, and particularly Just Above My Head, which is like my favorite James Baldwin novel. And it's one of the, I think, most beautiful depictions of love between Black men that I've read in literature, you know, or seeing Tongues Untied when I was in college, or, you know, by Marlon Riggs. Like, there were just always things that I would find that would affirm me, that would feed in, that would pour into me. And I think that's what really makes a difference. I mean, I think that's part of when we talk about the Counter Narrative Project, CNP, my organization, countering narratives. Part of countering narratives is creating messages that affirm, you know, affirm, especially LGBT folks. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that was just something I was really grateful for. Again, my experience perhaps may be unique. Everyone has a different story. But I am someone that grew up on the west side of Atlanta, grew up Southwest Atlanta in the 90s. And, you know, I perhaps grew up in communities that people don't see as being, you know, the most liberal around LGBTQ issues. So, but I've had both those experiences. And sometimes even as an activist, I feel like it's important to share those stories, because there were times in my life when I wasn't yet able to be courageous and I wasn't yet able to be, to speak up. And I had to develop that along the way. But part of what helped me develop that is that I had, you know, parents that, again, were supportive, and I had just people in my life that just poured into me. And I'm just tremendously grateful for that.
Well, it's it's funny because, like, I think what's happening now is, like, I'm pushing you to, like, you know, tell me something bad, you know, and you're like, no, actually, like, you'll mention it, but you'll be like, you know, I'm also really lucky and everything. And what I'm thinking about as I'm hearing you talk is, in a way, you're working counter-narrative right now, you know, even through this conversation, you know, and your whole attitude is so positive. It's amazing. It's really refreshing, to be honest with you, to hear, because your accent continues to be upon the positive aspects of what's happened for you personally. You
know, I acknowledge the pain, right? Like, yeah. I acknowledge the difficult parts of my journey, and I would not at all gloss over that. I mean, I, especially in, you know, and I think, I don't know what it is about middle school, but I think that was probably the hardest time, right?
Well, that's what I would think, that was, yeah, the hardest, it was time. Yeah,
really hard. But I also recognize that part of what got, because I wouldn't have survived, I don't think, in many ways, if I didn't have the other aspects of my life.
Yes, and some people don't, you know.
A lot of people don't.
And so, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, I think this is probably a good segue into the organization itself and what it's trying to do, the Counter Narrative Project. So you are listening to Alternative Perspectives, and we will be right back.
Put a spell on you.
Mark your calendar, get your tickets, and join us as the WRFG Labor Day Blues Barbecue returns to the Park Tavern at Piedmont Park on Monday, September 6th. It's going to be a great afternoon of live blues featuring Sandra Hall, Atlanta's Empress of the Blues and the city's leading female blues singer. The Shadows, Blind Willie's stalwart house band, back from a 16-month hiatus featuring their new guitarist, Rick Hinkle. Garrett Collins Project, a funky blues rock power trio who won the 2019 Atlanta Blues Challenge. Skylar Softly, a rising star from Phoenix City, Alabama, who plays 50s-style Chicago blues plus jump and swing. And more acts will be announced very soon. Bring your appetite, because the Park Tavern will be selling tasty barbecue and cool libations. Blues barbecue tickets are $17 in advance via wrfg.org or $22 at the door. Kids under 12, as always, get in free. We look forward to seeing you at the 36th Annual WRFG Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 6th at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park. The doors will open at noon, and the music will start at 1 p.m. The Park Tavern is located at 10th Street and Monroe Drive Northeast in Midtown Atlanta. Proceeds benefit WRFG 89.3 FM, your independent community radio station for hand-picked quality music and progressive information. For more information, visit WRFG.org.
All right, and we are back. You are listening to WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM, streaming at WRFG.org. This is Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's Queer Radio Hour. I am Greg Bossen, your host, and we are speaking with Charles Stevens, the founder and director, executive director of the Counter Narrative Project. So let's talk a little bit, if we could, Charles, about the Counter Narrative Project and what it's doing. So I looked at the mission of the organization, but I'll let you tell the little story about tell the story of the Counter Narrative Project and what you're trying to do specifically to help realize your mission. First of all, what is the mission?
Well, the mission of the Counter Narrative Project, or CNP, as we call it, we shift narratives to advance social change. We see ourselves at the intersection of narrative justice and social justice, which we feel makes us really unique, particularly in the Southern landscape, where there are many narratives that need to be shifted, especially as we think about what it means to move hearts and minds and also transform people. From our perspective, we see policy change and really social change is being rooted in narrative change. I think there are so many examples, even in our present moment, where we can see the connection between narratives, what's in the media, what people are saying, from sermons to newspaper articles to conversations to what actually happens in state legislatures.
Can you give an example?
Absolutely. One of the awful narratives that has circulated, particularly around Georgia, is around voter fraud. You know, there's this notion that there is this absolute false narrative around voter fraud, which then motivated the state legislature to enact these awful, laws making it more difficult for people to vote. And so folks that are fighting in the voting rights lane, which is extraordinarily important, one of the most important critical moments of our time, you know, they're having to confront these false narratives, and all they're trying to do is make democracy work by making voting possible for people and removing barriers to voting. And I think that that's just one example where you've seen just so many talking heads and so many, folks that are against making it easier for people to vote, creating these narratives that are just, that have just been debunked, when in fact, people should be able to vote, and that shouldn't be a daunting task.
I'll give you another one. This is a quote from Mark Levin, who is a right-wing radio talk show host on the Patriot Channel. Critical race theory is not about learning the history of America. Critical race theory is not about learning slavery and segregation. It's not about learning about neo-Nazis and the Klan. It's actually a Marxist movement invented by the Marxists, and it attracts Marxists like the Black Lives Matter founders. And Marxism is actually a belief that the working class makes itself the ruling class and should destroy the ruling class, and that then we'll live in a classless society, and there should be no government anymore, basically. Anyway, to me, they use that to try and say, we shouldn't be teaching critical race theory in schools. So that's just another narrative that I came across. But so what is your organization doing to try and counter these narratives that obviously affect policy?
Absolutely. But is it possible? Could I?
Yeah, go ahead. Address it.
Your part about just growing up in Atlanta, something that I just want to talk about.
Yeah, sure.
Another aspect of growing up in Atlanta that I don't think gets a lot of attention, certainly not stories that I've heard a lot about, isn't just the experience of homophobia in Black communities that many of us face growing up as Black gay men, but the experience of racism in the LGBTQ communities. I mean, I will say that I think some of my most challenging experiences around racism, the most blatant experiences of racism, have been in white LGBTQ spaces. And I mean, from the time, you know, being in high school, and of course, you know, there are varying degrees of that, from, you know, microaggressions to just the more sort of overt violent manifestations. But I do recall very clearly going to some, like, even in Midtown, going to some businesses, like just being a patron and having people not only condescend to me, but sometimes even harass me as a customer, or just, or the experience of other Black kids. I remember, like, particularly being a young adult, being a young Black gay man in the city, and those experiences of, and I mean, of course, it's also part of just the history of much of the of racism in the LGBTQ community, certainly from, you know, in the earlier days of having bars that would card people excessively, wanting 5 or 6 forms of ID to enter that some Black patrons experience. So I realized that, I mean, to talk about, if we are to talk about the challenges and the difficult experiences, that was really part of it. Because I think, especially as when I was a teenager and just looking for a community and looking for a place to affirm me and value me, you know, sometimes you go to Midtown, right? You go to Midtown, you go to some establishments, and you're looking for a community. And at the same time, I mean, I do remember also just being able to find, and it's part of how I was able to find other particularly teenagers when I was in high school. Like, I remember going to the teen group at the was called the Atlanta Gay and Lesbian Center. And, you know, just, I mean, it was something else, but I did, you know, I was able to make friends. I was able to find other kids, and it was really cool at the time. But, you know, I do realize that was something that I do think about now, just the evolution. And of course, there was also, you know, anti-racist allies and things like that.
But I do, I appreciate that you bring it up in the gay community, and it reminds me of a really close friend of mine who dated, who had a boyfriend for a time, and the boyfriend was just adamantly opposed to any white person dating a Black person. Thought it was just awful, you know, and that you know, that you need to stick with your own kind and everything. And I'm thinking to myself, dude, you're gay. Did you not learn anything from being a minority? It's like, what the hell? But it does. It's certainly part and parcel of the queer community, definitely. And I appreciate you bringing that up.
I mean, thank goodness that I was able to find a Black LGBTQ community, because there is a particular experience that you have that I remember having, you know, again, as a teenager in Atlanta, high school student, and you're looking for a community, and you think, you go to the neighborhood, and it just wasn't, it was bizarre.
What was the experience, Charles?
I mean, I found it, I think I became, like I said, I'm from Atlanta. So, and as I'd say probably 20 times, but I think when you're from Atlanta and you grow up in the city, there's just a particular orientation you have around race and your own sense of race. And I think that some of my early experiences dealing with racial difference, you know, happened in the LGBTQ community, and some of those experiences were certainly positive. But again, there were also, like, I mean, some of my most overt experiences of racism, and I don't even know if I had the language always to think about, to even talk about it, confronting, dealing with security and things like that. You know, it was just, because I mean, I think especially maybe around 2005, 2006, when I was, well, actually maybe before that, maybe like 2002, 2003, I think there were, I mean, of course, there's probably been many conversations about race in the LGBTQ community for years and years and years, but I do remember they're just trying to, this sense of, like, I guess you could call it almost like a reckoning with some of the LGBT businesses and organizations having to confront their own biases and such. But I think that also, so what does it have to do with CNP? Well, the connection is that just my own belief and passion about there being spaces for, you know, Black LGBTQ folks. I mean, certainly, I think there's a necessity to have spaces for solidarity, for alliance, for coalition. I think coalitions are important. But also think that, you know, I also think there's a value for our own spaces. I know you had a show about why is there a Black pride? I know that's a conversation that comes up pretty regularly, even still. Imagine some of those conversations may come up as we get closer to Black Pride Labor Day weekend. But I think that those experiences definitely helped me understand just the value and the sacredness of having spaces where we can, you know, certainly as Black LGBTQ people can come together and share our stories and affirm each other and have a sense of safety with each other, really. And I think CNP was a part of that. CNP was also the organization that I founded. It was also in many ways kind of me giving back to the community. I mean, I knew I wanted to start. At the point in which I realized that I wanted to start a nonprofit organization, I knew that I wanted to start it in Atlanta because, again, the city has just been, I think, so incredible to me. And I think that whatever superpowers I may have or whatever gifts I may have, I think it's really just from being from the city. I think that there's just something really special and amazing about just being connected to the city. And I wanted to give back. Our work and the work that I'm most proud of, as I shared, is really our narrative shift work. How do we do that? Well, one of the ways that we think about changing narratives, through one, creating content. So we have a YouTube channel where we share stories of Black LGBTQ people. We have a blog called The Reckoning, which is also a platform where we're able to share just incredible stories about our community. We're able to have a platform to amplify the voices of our community. And I think when it comes to countering narratives, particularly stigmatizing narratives, an important part of that is being able to create visibility. So through creating visibility, we're able to counter narratives, particularly stigmatizing narratives, because you have to confront someone's humanity when they're telling their story. And so that's just been an incredible part of our work through creating content, through creating platforms. We also have a summit every year where we bring leaders together to develop an advocacy agenda that helps us set our priorities around, particularly as it relates to our community mobilization efforts and our programmatic responses. So that's work that we're really excited about. In October, we're hosting our 7th anniversary. We're calling it CNP at 7. That's some work that we're really proud of. It's an opportunity to share with the community our plans for the upcoming year and also celebrate some of our accomplishments the previous year. And I think that as we look back on the past 12 months, particularly through 2020, through the rest of 2020 and even 2021, there's just so much to celebrate because it was, you know, again, just such a difficult time for so many of us. And yet we, you know, we were resilient, we endured, and we want to tell that story as well.
So you have, the idea is to bring members of your own community together to create or to I guess, explore your own narrative and then give visibility to that, to the wider community, but also to each other. I guess it feels like you're building internally, in a way, your own community.
Well, I think we're able to also raise awareness around issues impacting our community. So you will find throughout our various, the content we create and the platforms we put forth, you'll see us raising awareness around issues such as PrEP access and the importance of PrEP access. We did an entire video series about just people sharing their stories about not only taking PrEP, but also the barriers to PrEP and how they kind of dealt with those barriers. We've talked a lot and we've create a lot of educational materials and resources around how Black gay men are impacted by crystal meth. I think we're one of the, you know, which is a very unique lens in terms of just talking about harm reduction in the context of our work. We've had several webinars and programs focused on voting rights and just how Black LGBTQ people are uniquely impacted by voting rights. Now, to say that our community is uniquely impacted by something doesn't necessarily suggest that that there aren't ways to build connections across other movements and other communities. But so we're both wanting to highlight a very specific way that our community is impacted, but we also, you know, we also recognize the value of coalition building and working in broader movements. So that's been an important part of our work. We've also talked about stigma quite a bit, and HIV stigma specifically, and how our community is impacted by HIV stigma. So it's really not just about, so yes, we want to share stories, but it's also about raising awareness around issues impacting our communities. And to that extent, we see there being just an extraordinary educational resource that's being offered so that we are able to inspire activism. We're able to inspire better policies to be created. We're able to create blueprints so that organizers and activists and leaders are able to advance the issues that are impacting our community and respond to them. And we're also, you know, often we reach out to service providers. So people that provide services, be it HIV services or other kinds of social services, so that they have a better lens and perspective on the communities they're serving.
All right. I wondered, I mean, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I wondered, have you been able to or thought about getting into some of the schools for some of your work?
Yeah, so our work doesn't, we seek opportunities to partner with folks that do work in the K-12 educational space. So that work has looked like everything from, you know, a few years ago, we partnered with GLSEN to do a screening of the film Moonlight because we wanted to highlight the impact of the school to prison pipeline on Black LGBTQ youth. And that was work that we're really proud of. We partnered with GLSEN New York and Teach for America and some other organizations that do a lot of K-12 work. So that's an example of our seeking to connect to, K-12. We also had an opportunity to advocate to the Atlanta Board of Education to convene an LGBTQ task force to respond specifically around safety, the safety of students in the Atlanta Public Schools. So there was a task force that was created and a task force, the LGBTQ task force within the Atlanta Board of Education, Atlanta Public Schools, that really looked at safety. So that's some work that we're really proud of. So we've had many opportunities to do great partnerships. We have actually spoken to high schools before, high school students specifically. And, you know, in a lot of our work, we see it as really looking toward the future. You know, always one of the points of inspiration for me when I think about the work that I want to do and the kind of impact I have is that I do think about, you know, Black youth today. Another example, this is actually really critical early on in CNP that I want to share. You know, I think it was around 2015 or 16 or so, there was a student at Carver High School that reported being attacked for being gay. And we had an opportunity to convene community around that. We connected to the school board representative for the school. We engaged with the principal. I actually learned a lot about just the experiences of gay kids in schools and safety concerns, particularly there. But yeah, we've often sought to be responsive around, you know, certainly around, you know, issues that emerge. And I think we've, you know, really sought to have a voice, particularly as it relates to safety. That's something that's really important. And also someone that's, you know, that grew up in Atlanta and that was a part of the Atlanta public school system. That's something that remains important as well.
Cool. Well, thank you. I really do. Unfortunately, we were running out of time here, but I appreciate the work that you're doing and your own personal story. And again, I appreciate how positive you are. Your energy is very positive, and I think that's wonderful and needed, particularly when the type of work you're doing is challenging. It's definitely a slog trying to change the narratives. Where can people go to find out more information about CNP?
Yes, you can find us on social media. We can be found at CNP Tribe. That's at CNP Tribe. And we're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. But if awesome. You look that up, you'll be able to find us. And of course, you can go to our website, thecounternarrative.org.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. Charles, this was Charles Stevens, the founder and executive director of the Counter Narrative Project in Atlanta. Thank you so much for joining us. And that's going to be it for Alternative Perspective. Next up, we have the Peach State Festival. So thanks again. And as I always say, if you haven't gotten vaccinated, get vaccinated. Quit being stupid. I'll see you next week.